Mr. Okemu, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Nagudi Okemu, and I'm the appellant in the case, and I'm proceeding pro se. The subject of my appeal was based on approximately four issues. The first issue was that the trial court lacked jurisdiction to issue the January 27th order that subjected me to contempt, in that they did not have jurisdiction over my person. I was never served with the application for the temporary guardianship. In that application, the appellee, they had sought relief from me, and yet in their brief they contend that I did not have to be served. Your Honor, my argument is that if someone is going to be subjected to relief, if relief is sought against somebody, the dictates of due process are that that person should be served with that notice so that he can have an opportunity to prepare and defend himself. That was not the case here. This honorable court should note. I was simply ambushed in court when I went to attend a hearing, and that was it. They said that, hey, he's here. Let's order him to disgorge certain funds. There was no proof or no indication that there was any wrongdoing on my part to disgorge those funds. So that's one, the first basis of my brief. The second basis of my appeal is that the court lacked jurisdiction over the proposed ward herself. Miss Emily Bays was a long-term friend of mine. That was like a mother to me, like a grandmother to my children for over 11 years. Now, when the appellees, when they tried to have a guardianship proceedings over a temporary guardianship under Section 875, she was never personally served. And I believe case law is clear that, you know, to have a guardianship over a person, I mean, it's a grave matter. They should be personally served so that they could at least defend themselves or, you know, have an opportunity to appear. This never happened here. They supposed to have served her through Rule 106, substituted service. But, Your Honor, I have yet to find a case anywhere that says that a substituted service is proper for an alleged incapacitated person. And even then, if it is, it was so defective because they supposed to have left the substituted service only a few hours before the hearing. Okay? Probate Code 875 says that a proposed incapacitated person should have a right to be served, a right of notice, and a right to appear.
How do you respond to the appellee's argument that you don't have standing to raise arguments concerning Ms. Bays? You may have standing to raise arguments concerning yourself, but that you don't have standing to raise arguments concerning service on Ms. Bays.
Yes, Judge Walker, I read that, but it's my contention that I really do have standing to contest the service on Ms. Bays because, number one, I was the only beneficiary and of her will, which has duly been filed for probate. Number two, Ms. Bays had left me what is called she had left a document that in case of incapacity, I should be the one to be appointed guardian. Number three, I had the power of attorney. Number four, there was a long-term relationship between me and her. I was not just a mere power of attorney holder. There was a 11-year relationship between me and Ms. Bays. And that order, number four, I was contesting that order also. I was a contestant to her guardianship. So basically, if she was going to be subjected to the jurisdiction of the court and she was never served, I believe that, you know, I had standing to raise those issues, Judge.
But none of those issues would have even been known at the time she was going to be served.
Yes, they were known, Your Honor, because I had filed a notice with the court that I was a power of attorney, that any notices should be served with any notices in that case. They had long known that I was the only person taking care of Ms. Bays, and that is in their suggestion for need and in their investigation report. So it was not a secret that I was there. And number three, I had counsel at that time. I think it was Mr. Yablon, and he was never even served with the notice himself that there was going to be a hearing on a temporary guardianship on Ms. Bays. So because I was so much affected by it, I was a contestant, I was the sole beneficiary of Ms. Bays' estate, and I had a long-term relationship with Ms. Bays, I contend that I have standing to challenge the defective service on her. Okay. Going to service on myself that was defective, and I believe I've gone through that in my first issue. It goes against the Texas Constitution and the United States Constitution just to order somebody to pay certain monies that he has not been given an opportunity to defend. And then and then coupled with that order that of January 27th was arbitrary and ambiguous. It ordered basically me to pay back any monies that I could have withdrawn or Ms. Bays could have withdrawn from October to end of January. I mean, they had not established that Ms. Bays could not withdraw her own funds. So how possible could I have given them the money withdrawn by Ms. Bays? Ms. Bays was perfectly competent to withdraw her own money. They seemed to rely on a suggestion for need failed by Ms. Bays' physician, that Ms. Bays was somehow lacked capacity. But they failed to tell you in their brief that the same physician had indicated in a hearing that he did grave error, that Ms. Bays was in fact not incapacitated at all. And they seemed to ignore that. And therefore, Ms. Bays was perfectly incapacitated. She could withdraw her own money. She could direct me to withdraw money. And in the order, it said that I should be able to return all funds withdrawn by me, withdrawn by Ms. Bays. That was ambiguous because I could not possibly be able to do that. Ms. Bays was acting on her own. She was a hard-willed woman, and she did as she pleased. So in that respect, the order was very ambiguous. It was also ambiguous in terms that she was never served with this with the order, with the first guardianship procedure until November 26th, the application for appointment for guardianship. She was never served with that until November 26th of 2008. Yet, that order said that I should be able to refund all monies withdrawn by her, withdrawn by me from October, I think from the 1st of October. That is in itself ambiguous. And the monies themselves were not definite. They say any monies from anywhere. So that was an ambiguous order. And that order, honorable members of the court, subjected me to contempt. I was in jail for nearly 5 months. And had it not been for intervention of this court, I really don't know how long I could have been in jail. And for that, I was thankful. The last issue, honorable members of the court, is that after the death of the ward, after the death of Ms. Bays, the appellee, in his capacity as guardian of the estate, he had no standing really to pursue a contempt hearing, because when a ward dies, the guardianship ends, according to Probate Code 745A2. They argue, the Supreme Court holding in Wembley, that an estate can continue despite the death of the ward. But that case, Your Honor, or gentlemen of the court, it is not controlling. The Wyoming case, the Supreme Court dealt with settlement of the disputes that are there when the word dies. In this case, there was no real dispute. They were just conjecturing or contemplating that, hey, Mr. Kumu may have some money, we're going to order him to pay. They had not proved that I had any money. There was no debt that they were trying to settle, because for there to be a settlement of a debt, they have to establish that debt. Honorable members of this court, there was no debt at that time. They were merely conjecturing that, hey, I may have some money that I may owe to Ms. Bates, therefore, they're going to collect it. Your Honor, I believe that Wyoming does not apply, and your long ruling in Jibs that the guardianship ends at the death of the ward should stand. And they argue that the holding in Bain, I believe that's a case from Dallas, says otherwise. But I believe this court rejected that argument in Jibs and held that Jibs is contrary to Section 875H, and I believe it is. But even if this court follows Bain, still the court should hold that they did not have jurisdiction, because see, in Bain at least, there was a dispute as to the debts to be paid. I did not have any debts owing to the estate of Ms. Bates at that time, and therefore the appellee, they did not have standing to proceed after the death of Ms. Bates. I mean, it's not like their case was completely gone. They could have still followed me pursuant to being administrators of the estate as they have done after that. But they decided to go ahead without the law and pursue this claim, which they should not have. And again, I would go back to the issue of service on Ms. Bates and stress cases like in the matter of Gonzalez, which held that a proposed ward has to be served, whether it is a temporary guardianship or it is a permanent guardianship. And also the holding in the matter of Saldarriaga versus Saldarriaga, that case also held that it is very important to personally serve a proposed ward of an estate because of the liberty involved. If you're going to take away somebody's liberty, somebody's property rights, they ought to be served. And this is clearly the intent of the legislature and what all these cases that I have briefed reveal. Perry versus Perry addressed that legislative intent, that really, even if somebody, you think that it is very important to get this temporary guardianship, but their rights to their person and their rights to their property is even more important. And so at least they should be afforded an opportunity of notice, and also they should be afforded an opportunity to be present. Or if they cannot be present, the court should ensure that their right to be present is preserved.
Mr. Kuma.
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor.
You mentioned the will.
Yes.
What's the status of the application for probate of the will of Ms. Bates?
Yeah, the will is still pending in probate court number 2, Your Honor. It's been filed and it's pending. I think there was a supposedly boyfriend of Ms. Bates' son that is contesting it, but Ms. Bates' son had also passed away a few weeks after Ms. Bates died. So the will is still pending, Your Honor.
You said in your argument a moment ago that under the terms of Ms. Bates' will, you are the sole beneficiary of her estate.
Yes, Your Honor, myself and my two young children. Ms. Bates raised them. They are now 15 and 13. They got the mineral rights, and I got the house and everything else.
Has there been any contest in the probate of the will, on the application of the probate of the will? Has there been any contest filed by any person assuming the position of an ad litem or an guardian of a person of Ms. Bates that are involved in this lawsuit? In other words, has there been a guardian of the estate take an action in the probate, in the file in the probate court that deals with the probate of the will?
No, Your Honor, not the guardian of the estate, but as I said, there has been a supposedly boyfriend of Ms. Bay's son in California who died, and he was appointed an executor in that will in California, and apparently is trying to contest this will on behalf of Mr. Bay's, who passed away. But the guardian of the estate, the temporary guardian of the estate, they have not filed anything.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Judge. I have no further points.
May it please the court. Point of clarification for Justice Meyer's question. The status of the probate is that Mr. Okumu did file a will for probate, and it is pending. And there is a contest filed by the heir of Ms. Bay's son, who happened to die about a month after Ms. Bay's. What Mr. Okumu failed to tell the court is that the will he filed for probate is defective. It does leave him Ms. Bay's house. It does leave Ms. Bay's mineral interest in Erath County to his two children, but the will does not have a residuary clause. So the residuary of the estate, which presumably would be the cash that is really the subject of this case, is going to pass to his heirs at law, and Mr. Okumu and his kids are not heirs at law. Instead, the contestant is the heir, the recipient, the beneficiary of Mrs. Bay's son's estate as established in a California court. So he is the contestant.
What role does the guardianship have in the settling of the estate in the probate matter involving the will of Ms. Bay's?
None at all, Your Honor. In the temporary guardianship, I do believe it is over at this point. It was not over on January 27th, as Mr. Okumu alleges, but the temporary guardian is Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo is also the temporary administrator of the estate. So it is still attempting to collect and finalize the assets of the estate for the eventual handoff to the beneficiaries under the will, under whichever will is admitted to probate or heirs at law or however the court may ultimately direct.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. First thing I was hoping the court would take a look at is, as I frequently ask myself each day, you know, why are we even here? Mr. Okumu has made it clear at least in his reply brief, that he's only appealing the January 27th order that created a temporary guardianship. It's uncontested that Ms. Bay's is now deceased. So even if the court were to decide that there's no temporary, that the whatever reason, the order creating a temporary guardianship was invalid, so what? Ms. Bay's is still deceased. We're not going to bring her back to life. A finding by the court strictly confined to should there have been a temporary guardian, whether it's the service issues, as he alleges, or any of his other complaints, we still don't have anything that this court can solve by issuing that narrow of an opinion. Now, I do believe that res judicata applies. Mr. Okumu did file two habeas petitions, and I don't pretend to be a criminal law expert, but the way I read TRAP Rule 31.5, this court's initial ruling in the first habeas petition, as I've cited in my brief, seems to me under TRAP Rule 31.5 to have been final and conclusive because he made the same arguments that he just made to the court about he wasn't served with a notice of the temporary guardianship hearing. He didn't have proper notice in his opinion that he was going to be asked to do anything. Therefore, the court's requirement that he disgorge money and account to the court was improper, leading to his incarceration, which he believes is improper. Even in his reply brief, he seems a little bit confused. His reply to his point A on page 5 of his reply brief says, "It is clear that appellant is not appealing the contempt order of February 5, 2009, or challenging the same in this proceeding." Yet, on page 16 of the same reply brief, argument E, he discusses at length that the court lacked jurisdiction to prosecute him for the violation of the January 27 order to disgorge the funds. So this is the whole thing still wrapped up in the same package as the habeas petition was, actually both habeas petitions. So I tried to get my brain around what is he trying to do, and I believe what he's trying to do is set up the following dominoes, because this is the only solution I can think of. He wants the court to make a ruling that there was never a valid temporary guardianship, so therefore there could never have been a valid order for him to disgorge money and account to what he had taken from Ms. Bay's. Therefore, his incarceration was invalid, and he was wronged in that way. And then he's going to use that evidence, I suppose, in the one of the other two pending appeals in this court of the jury trial that occurred in May of this year, where he was found to have converted money of the decedent. You know, there was evidence of $450,000 disappearing from her accounts. The jury found that he converted $200,000, which was in an annuity that he knew about in January of 2009 and failed to disclose to the court. So I think if he can get all those dominoes lined up, he believes that he will have a better shot at showing the jury that while the temporary administrator might later have discovered the money that he was hiding, it was improper to have asked him to bring it forth in January of 2009.
Mr. Banyan.
Yes, sir.
Let's talk about some dominoes on your side. Where in the record is there a filed document that represents the return of citation by Mr. Russell on the 106 order?
It is in the supplemental record, Your Honor, that we filed. I'll give you the date.
I saw in your brief you referenced the testimony of Mr. Russell and the statement.
Yes, sir, and it's either in, there were two supplemental, there's one supplemental clerk's record, and it was filed September 11 of 2009 in the court, and that does have a copy of the citation. The citation was in the probate clerk's file all the time. The confusing part about it, if the court looks at that supplemental clerk's record, it'll see that there were initially two file marks on that document. The first one preceded the date and time of the hearing. The second one was a couple of days later. And in talking with the clerk and trying to figure out what the heck happened, somebody being trained stamped that document a second time, but it still bore the earlier file stamp that was prior to the hearing that preceded Mr. Russell's testimony.
Mr. Russell testified that they obtained a 106 a 106 motion was filed, and that and the order was entered on the day before the hearing, on the 26th, January the 26th.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And at that point in time, the were you aware, was it a matter of understanding between the lawyers that you knew that Ms. Bays had gone to the hospital and was in the hospital?
Your Honor, point of clarification, I was not involved in the case at that time. I attended the hearing, but I was not yet representing a party. But from what I have learned, Mr. Okumu has alleged that Ms. Bays was in the hospital. There's absolutely no evidence to that effect. Mr. Russell testified at the hearing, and I heard him testify, and it's also in the record, that he went to the house on the 26th. Ms. Bays was in the house. He heard Mr. Okumu in the house, but she would not come to the door, and he ended up leaving it on the door as the 106 authorized him to do. He also testified, I think, having gone out there the Sunday, the Saturday, and the Friday before that, before getting the 106, and finding that she would not come to the door, but believing that she was in the house. So I don't know exactly when she went to the hospital, but there's no evidence in this record, and no evidence was even adduced at the jury trial in May that's also on appeal about the timing of her medical entries and exits from the hospital.
That's the second reference you've made to a jury trial. Now, are we looking at a jury trial here in this appeal? Or
no,
are we
sir.
Looking at
I was referring to cause number 0209279,
I understand that,
which
but
is
I'm
a different.
Saying that our attention today is directed at the appeal that's before us.
Yes, sir.
In this part of the probate court,
yes,
court action.
Yes, sir.
In light of the fact that the probate court has taken an action in appointing the temporary guardian of the person and the estate.
Yes, sir.
And we're not dealing with jury trials or any other aspect of handling of this matter in the probate court, are we?
No, we're not.
Now, upon what basis are you understanding that there was medical testimony that Ms. Bays was incapacitated?
The testimony that we heard at the January 27th hearing was again limited to the temporary guardianship, Your Honor, and there is no requirement that in a temporary guardianship the court Well, in fact, the court cannot, by statute, make a finding of incapacity. What the court can do is make a finding that there is an emergency, either to Award's person or to her estate. And that was the substance of the testimony on January 27th, was that there was an emergency that couldn't wait for a hearing on the permanent guardianship where medical testimony would have been required. Now, there was testimony by Catherine Goodman as to her attempts to interact with Ms. Bays and her interviews with other witnesses who had seen Ms. Bays. And, of course, Ms. Bays' attorney ad litem, the appointed attorney to represent her, was there and, of course, participated in the process. But there, I don't know that there was direct testimony about her health at that January 27 hearing, because the issue was more she needs protection, we need to do something in a hurry.
Is there a certificate from Dr. Leffingwell?
Yes, there was. Dr. Leffingwell's certificate started the process in September when I forget if it was filed before or at the same time as what is called a 683 letter, which was from a social worker saying, hey, we got a problem. Mr. Okumu's close to her. He may be taking her money. We're not sure. We need to do something. Dr. Leffingwell then submitted a letter on the court's form indicating that she was totally incapacitated. At a hearing in, I think, mid-January, Dr. Leffing, and I don't know what the substance of why there was a hearing because I wasn't involved, but from reading the record, he was called to court to testify where he totally recanted everything he said previously, all, again, back to September. He had started basically the process in motion. And then in mid-January, he says, King's X, Judge, I was wrong. I didn't understand what I was doing, something like that.
And, in fact, he changed the part of the certificate where he had indicated he thought she was incapacitated to an indication that he did not believe she was incapacitated.
That's correct. He did.
And do you know when that occurred?
For some reason, Your Honor, January 11 sticks out in my mind. I know it's in the clerk's record, but I can't swear that that's the correct date.
And so other than the issue of what testimony was presented in the hearing on the 27th, there wasn't any testimony that Ms. Bays was incapacitated or and the need for the emergency that existed was what evidence was presented in the hearing on the 27th. That's in our statement.
That's correct. That's correct.
And so the position is we have a 93-year-old lady who may be in a warm house and may not have total recollection of every medicine she's taken. And then for that reason, she's in an emergency circumstance to where we need to take over her estate.
Your Honor, you've described basically what happens in any temporary guardianship, but I think if you read the record from the January 27 hearing, you'll see that even without Dr. Leffingwell's letter, after 4 months of investigation by the attorney ad litem and the guardian ad litem, there were ample witnesses as to the fact that there was an emergency, both the fact that nobody could meet with her, there were depositions scheduled of her, there was a pending motion to have another medical examination done at the time Ms. Bays died. So in every temporary guardianship, Your Honor, by statute, the court is not required to make any finding that the person is incapacitated. In fact, the statute, I think it's in 875, says that any creation of a temporary guardianship does not create any presumption of incapacity because we're dealing with an emergency. The court, by statute and process, doesn't have time to make that determination. What was alleged in the motion for the temporary was that hundreds of thousands of dollars of Ms. Bays had disappeared from accounts,
I understand it, and okay. I've read the record, and I've read this transcript you're talking about a couple of times. And my concern is that I don't see in the transcript that the issues of what Ms. Bays may have been interested in for herself were developed by any of the people who were appointed attorney ad litem, that were appointed a temporary guardian, that were appointed any other capacity to represent her at this hearing. No one said, Ms. Bays doesn't want this.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the attorney who was Ms. Bays' advocate, William Fitzgerald, was in favor of having a temporary guardian appointed, and he was the one charged by law to represent her. He participated in the hearing, and any representation of her to express the concerns expressed by you here today were his to make.
He didn't make them, did he?
What is his charge? What is his duty in that capacity, Mr. Fitzgerald?
by statute, an attorney ad litem must advocate for the ward. But again, advocating for the
for
ward.
For the ward does not, or what's best for the ward?
No, what's in the ward's best interest is the duty of the guardian ad litem. But the attorney ad litem is to advocate for her. But again, for everyone on this court, advocating for a person doesn't mean taking positions that I think are unreasonable or not likely to protect the person. And I mean, it's not in the record, but Mr. Fitzgerald has been involved in this process all along, and he was as concerned as anybody else with the money that had disappeared and his own inability to get to his client because he was continually shielded by Mr. Okumu from getting to his own client. So if he had objections, Your Honor, it was his job to bring them, and it's not Mr. Okumu's to step in now as Ms. Bays' de facto attorney.
Mr. Brannion, I have a question.
Yes.
You began your argument talking about that the challenge we're addressing here today is strictly to the temporary guardianship order. And I understood your argument to be one of mootness, basically,
yes.
That there's no live controversy at this point
yes.
in light of Mrs. Bays' death.
Yes.
Is there a case on that? Is there a case law that you can cite? I mean, it appears that this would have happened before, that there's a temporary guardianship that's awarded and then mooted out by a subsequent death. Is there a case law that subsequent death of the ward would moot a temporary guardianship order?
No, I don't. I mean, the cases that have been cited by in the briefs, the Womling case, the Bain case, the Gibbs case, all involved actions taken following the death of a ward in a temporary guardianship. But the point is, for example, in the, I believe it was the Gibbs case that this court decided, the Bain case was in Dallas, there were still controversies that existed between live parties. The Bain case, I think, involved was the correct temporary guardian appointed because the one that got removed was mad and they wanted to fight about that. So the appellate court said, yeah, hey, we still have a controversy even though the ward died, and whatever we decide here is going to make a difference as to who settles the estate. But in this case, in the Bays case, we don't have that situation. We don't have a dispute really between two living persons if we confine it to the January 27 order, because if Mr. Okumu is correct and there never should have been a temporary guardianship, so what? Because we still end up with no controversy that this court is going to solve by making a ruling. Now, when the court hears the other two appeals, yeah, there's stuff going on there. But in this narrow case, unless he is, as I suspect, still trying to litigate why he got held in contempt, there is nothing as confined to that temporary guardianship, and I would cite as authority the Bain and the Gibbs case and the Womling for instances where there were still controversies pending versus this case where there's really nothing that we're going to solve here today.
Thank you.
I have one last question.
Yes, sir.
You indicated that in terms of the current position of the temporary guardianship, that things that wound down and were now completed?
The temporary guardian has filed its final accounting, and the final accounting has been approved. And the way it works, as I'm sure you're aware, is the handoff is then made to the temporary administrator, which again is Wells Fargo. And that was the final accounting and stuff was done early this fall and was recently approved. So it takes a while, as this court recognized in the Gibbs case, to settle an estate when you're in a statutory probate court.
Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Thank you, Your Honors.
The Honorable Court, if I may respond to a few points that Mr. Brannion was asked, especially by Honorable Meyer. He was asked whether there was a certificate, a medical certificate by Dr. Leffingwell. Yes, there was another one on November 26th. Dr. Leffingwell issued another certificate saying that Ms. Bays was very competent. So there was, November 26th, Dr. Leffingwell issued another certificate. As to the attorney ad litem, Mr. Fitzgerald, who was supposed to be Ms. Bays' attorney in attorney ad litem in the guardianship matter, he had filed an answer contesting the guardianship. So attorney ad litem was contesting the guardianship of Ms. Bays. Ms. Bays herself was vehemently opposed to the guardianship. In fact, she tried to hire her own counsel, Stubbs in Dallas, the Stubbs law firm. He tried to fire those lawyers through. He did not want the attorney ad litem. She did not communicate with him. And There was no evidence on the record or anywhere that I was the one that was preventing Ms. Bays from communicating with these people. Ms. Bays was a very bright woman and very hard-willed woman. And she was, of course, very angry that this process had started over her, and she did not want these people. That was very clear, and it was not me. Now, as to the process server, the service on Ms. Bays was supposed to have been done on the 26th. Ms. Bays had a stroke on the 25th, and she was at Arlington Memorial Hospital.
Is that in the record?
Well, yes, when at the hearing, it is in the record. I had indicated, and my counsel then had indicated to the court that, Your Honor, Ms. Bays is not even at home. Ms. Bays is at Arlington Memorial Hospital. Okay. Now, on the return of service of the process server, on the date of the hearing, that was the 27th of January, there was no return of service on the record. Myself and my attorney, we looked, there was none. Now, apparently, something appeared on the record later on that on the 27th, the process server had done a return of service. But nonetheless, a return of service, only a few hours, the hearing was 10:30, and the return of service was also at 10 o'clock. And the service pursuant to the substituted service was about 5 o'clock on the 26th. So how realistic is that, ladies and gentlemen, honorable members of the court? I mean, you cannot serve somebody at 5 o'clock and expect them to be in court tomorrow at 10 o'clock. So there was no, the service, the return of service pursuant to Texas Rules of Procedure 107 was really defective. 10 o'clock and the hearing was 10 o'clock. And I believe there has to be a return of service 10 days before a hearing has to go on. That was not the case here.
Now, doesn't 10-day apply to default judgment?
Yes, but I looked at that, and my position is that this judgment against Ms. Bays was really a default judgment because she was at the hospital, she was contesting the guardianship, she had tried to hire other lawyers contesting the guardianship.
But she was present through her lawyer.
She was supposed to be present through her lawyer, but it says that, I think that the law says that her lawyer cannot waive her appearance or her notice. So she was supposed to be present through her lawyer, but she had tried to fire that lawyer. She was contesting the whole thing. She had tried to hire her own independent lawyers. And again, on the will, Mr. Brannion tends to make you believe that this will is defective. I mean, the court has not decided that this will is defective. Of course, it is Mr. Brannion. He would like for everything to be defective. That has been his position all along. So that will is still pending in probate. Okay, there was no residuary clause in it. I understand that. But I did not prepare the will, and Ms. Bays, that was her intention, because she had moved her money willingly in other areas. So she did not have any money to go in the will. She had bought an annuity, me and her. She took me to the court to buy an annuity. She had transferred her money to her house because she did not want these people to take her money. Ms. Bays was a hard-willed woman. So for them to argue that this will is defective, that's according to him, not according to any court. The probate court has not decided that the will is defective.
What order are you appealing here today?
January 27th order, Your Honor. And if
the
I
January
may,
27th order?
Yes, that's the order appointing the temporary guardianship of Ms. Bays on the basis that I was never served with it. It subjected me to relief, subjected me to contempt. I was in jail for nearly 5 months because of that order. And this res judicata that appellee tried to argue is really inapplicable. When I was in jail for nearly 5 months.
Counsel, your time has expired. Thank you very much. We appreciate your arguments here today. Your case is submitted. And Ms. Spisak will adjourn the court.